From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy, social, and civil rights issues affecting communities of color. I'm Kim Atterbury, Senior Director of Communications and External Affairs, and this week I'm flying solo. Jordan is on a much-needed vacation, Don is on military leave until October, and Mark is traveling. But we've still managed to squeak out a great episode for you where we discuss Black Republicans, fact versus fiction. Our guest is Elroy Saylor, founder of Inside America and Republican strategist. Elroy, as I'm sure you know, a lot of people, and particularly Black people, are curious about African Americans that politically affiliate with the Republican Party. So I thank you for joining me today to share your story and experience.
Well, Kim, thank you for having me. And let me first Just say thank you. Thank Mark Moriel. Thank Don. The work that you all are doing to take information inside the Beltway, inside our nation's capital, and make sure it reaches communities of color, in particular communities like the one that I grew up in, Detroit, is an amazing thing. It's something that needs to happen. So first, again, just thank you for doing that. And then thank you for giving me the opportunity to come on and talk about and share my experiences.
No, thank you. Thank you. So to begin, what led you and maybe others to become a Republican?
You know, I'm still trying to figure that out. No, on a serious note, I grew up in Detroit, the real Detroit. It wasn't the suburbs. I grew up on 7 Mile and Woodward. My father was a millwright at Ford Motor Company. He had no more than a high school degree and some trade school experience. My mother was a social worker, had gone on to work on her master's, starting in community college and working her way through a 4-year college and then a master's program. Jesse and Nancy Violi Saylor, my mother, my grandmother, my grandfather, they had 16 kids, I want to say 16 kids, and about 50 to 60 first cousins and grandkids. So we grew up in a typical family in Detroit. My folks are from Montezuma, Georgia. They came up here with the Black migration out of the South looking for jobs. My father and mother raised 3 kids. And, I learned my values from my mother and my father and my grandmother and my grandfather and the men and women who have been in my life over the last 40-something years. I'm not going to date myself because you're about 22 years old.
I wish.
I'm not going to date myself. As I started matriculating, through school, K through 12, you're not thinking about politics at that point. You're just a knucklehead kid running around the streets of Detroit playing football and stickball and playing video games and breakdancing. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know much about. But, while I was in middle school and while I was in elementary school, I spent a lot of time with my grandmother and my grandfather. We didn't have a whole lot of money for a babysitter in the summer. So if you were a Saylor kid and it was 20, 30 kids in a 2-bedroom house. And, we learned some basic values there. As I went on to college, I started Morehouse College at 16 years of age, and I graduated at 20 years of age. So I was still a knucklehead kid down at an all-African-American school in HBCU, Morehouse College, and had some great professors. Interesting enough, many of my professors were center-left in their philosophy, and many of the students who had attended Morehouse College were center-left. And again, many of the people who grew up in Detroit, if you had to classify folks in my community and from my family, you would probably classify them as Democrats. But I think the term Democrat and Republican is really overrated. Mm-hmm. Now that I've been in politics for, almost 20, 30 years. When I graduated from Morehouse College, I made some very bad decisions in my life. I didn't make mistakes, and I always like to clarify that I made some bad decisions. And, Kim, I spent my 21st birthday incarcerated in federal prison. I graduated with really good grades and started school at 16, and like I said, made some bad decisions. Raised with a mom and a dad, a strong grandmother, grandfather, had very good values. But, sometimes you get beside yourself and start thinking too much of yourself, and you go down a bad track, and that happened to me. Well, I got an opportunity at the age of 21 to spend my 21st birthday incarcerated, and I was in a gated community. Probably not like the community that many of our educated Black folks live in today. They can come in and out of that gated community, but I couldn't come in and out of this gated community. And I tell you, Kim, I spent some time with men who had been incarcerated for a long, long time. I spent some time with, you know, guys who were made some very bad decisions. I spent some time with some folks who probably shouldn't have been there. And I spent some time with some folks who definitely should be there, and I hope they're not out. All right. My experiences have been very, very unique. Mm-hmm. Going to Morehouse College at 16 and spending my 21st birthday in a gated community. When I got out of the gated community and when the federal government allowed me to get back and matriculate back into society, I was 3 years on probation. And during that time, I couldn't find a job. I applied over and over and over. Morehouse College had interned actually in the Bush White House in 1988 as a junior out here. And I'll go back to that, but I wanted to set the stage with this. And sometimes it gets a little sensitive for me to talk about mm-hmm. this, so bear with me. So during that time of being on probation, I wanted to go back to law school. I had been accepted into several law schools, but my probation officer, she would not let me go to law school. So took that dream away from me. She said I had to work to pay back restitution. So I went and applied to GM, Ford, Chrysler, every job you can think of in the state of Michigan, and everybody turned me down because I had a federal conviction, mm-hmm. right? So I end up getting a job as a 23-year-old black male with a college degree and had really, really done well in school. And I was a waiter at Pizza Hut making, I think, $3.25 an hour. And I waited at night because while I was in a gated community, one thing I found the Lord, and my faith just grew exponentially. And I learned in that time of being away that faith is all you have and family. So I learned that there. When I kept my days open, and because I was a political science major, econ minor, and I told myself through prayer and support that I was going to continue my dream of being in public policy at some level and being involved in government and politics at some level. That's why I was a political science major. So I worked at Pizza Hut at night. Mm-hmm. I volunteered during the day on a Republican from Beale City, John Engler from Michigan. Now, I didn't volunteer on his campaign because I was a Republican. It actually was a ballot initiative. So I believed in the ballot initiative. It was a cut and cap initiative. They were dealing with some property taxes. And it was the equivalent of what we would call allowing kids from low-income neighborhoods now to receive a voucher to go to a school of their choice.
Okay.
So it was a funding formula that they were trying to get passed, not through the Congress. I mean, not through the state legislature, but they were trying to get it passed through the through a ballot initiative. So I worked on that, okay, for a summer. And after that, I got a chance to meet a lot of Republicans. I had already known all the Democrats because I grew up in Detroit. And I decided at that point to apply for a job with Governor John Engler. He was running for governor. And so I worked on his campaign. He won. And, Kim, you know, I applied 3 times. And every time, because my parents weren't Republicans, they were not big fundraisers. We were not involved in Republican politics. I'm just a kid from Detroit who had a different and a unique opportunity. So I took that opportunity. After 3 times, I was told no, finally got an interview, ended up working in the governor's mailroom. Well, working in the governor's mailroom, I got an opportunity to read. There's like 8.6 million people in the state of Michigan. I can't tell you how much mail I read back in the early 90s because people weren't emailing and that stuff. So I learned all about real issues. And it wasn't just issues that impacted my community, my poor black communities, issues that impacted farming communities, rural communities, suburban communities, upper income communities, no income communities. And I really learned a lot. By the time I got finished working for Governor John Engler, I had been promoted to one of the youngest cabinet secretaries in the state of Michigan. I was responsible for urban affairs. Mm-hmm. I had worked on Capitol Hill with Senator Abraham from Michigan, and then I had worked with J.C. Watt. So that's just a little bit of background along the way. Met my wife when I was 16 years old. We named our kids my freshman year, E. Clay, Clayburn Prescott Saylor, and Alamni DeJay Saylor. My daughter's now at West Point doing very, very well. My son is in boarding school, and I miss him to death, so I'm an empty nester. But that's a little bit of background on mm-hmm. me. So, because I wanted to set that stage. Now, to answer your question directly, I did not become a Republican because what I thought the Republican Party could do for me, nor did I become a Republican because of what I thought the Republican Party could do for our community or our country. I became a Republican because in 1988, when I had an opportunity to come work in the Republican administration for George H.W. Walker Bush, the father, there were several students at Morehouse College in our political science department, maybe 10 of them. I don't remember the exact 10 of us. I don't remember the exact number. But let's say there were 10 of us. Well, all nine, and initially all 10 of us were going to go work for the CBC. Mm-hmm. And I've always kind of pushed the envelope. Maybe that's why I got into trouble and made some bad decisions. Sometimes I push the envelope too much. So I went to my professor and I went to my other partners and my brothers at Morehouse. I said, hey, aren't there like two parties? Why are we all going to go work for the Democratic Party? That just didn't make any sense to me. We're here to learn. I want to learn what everyone is doing. I don't care if you're a libertarian or a Democrat or a progressive or a conservative. I think in the black community, we have to learn and be everywhere. So I stepped out on faith and I told my professor and my other Morehouse brothers, hey, guys, I'm going to go apply in the Republican Party. You guys can go do the Democrats. And I said to them, I said, well, hey, why don't five of us go work in the Republican administration? Why don't five of us go work in the Democrat administration? Well, they weren't having it. They're not working for the Republican, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, that's honestly straightforward how I became a Republican. It was in 1988 because I saw a need as a young junior at Morehouse College to say we need to have black people in the Republican Party. So that's my first entree into mm-hmm. Republican politics was in 1988. Now, after I got out of college, remember, I spent 3 years on probation. I spent some time incarcerated. And it even, during that time of being in a gated community and on probation, my commitment to my community, my commitment to criminal justice reform, education, making sure that black men take care of our black women, making sure that we take care of our kids, making sure that we create partnerships, all the things that every other community does to make this nation great. That 1 year capitalized it for me. I got stripped down to nothing. And when I got stripped down to nothing and came out, I said, hey, what can I do? What can I do mm-hmm. with the little bitty voice that I have, with the little amount of energy that our Savior in Christ gives us? What can I do? I said, well, I looked at the two-party system. I'm a political science major. I said, there's not a whole lot of people that look like me with my experiences trying to make a difference in the party. So I joined the Republican Party because I wanted to make a difference. Is that simple? I wanted to make a difference.
So what does being a black Republican mean to you?
You know, being a black Republican, to me, it means that I happen to be black, of course. It means that I made a decision to join the Republican Party, of course. But more importantly, it means that I have a commitment to my community. Mm-hmm. It means that I have a commitment to the fellas that I met while I was in a gated community. It means that I have a commitment to my cousins and my family and the folks that I grew up with in Detroit. It means that I have a broader commitment to my community and the world. And what it means is that I'm going to work inside a party that has center-right positions on various issues and issues where I disagree with the party. I use that opportunity to be that voice in the room that says, hey, President Bush, when I've sat in the Oval Office with the president and Karl Rove and Andy Card, and had an opportunity when we were discussing American Community Renewals and New Markets Tax Credits and education, I was fortunate and blessed to literally sit in the Oval Office. And I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying that because I was grateful and it was an honor that I had the opportunity to do that. When I worked on Capitol Hill and when we were debating affirmative action, I had an opportunity to work with J.C. Watts, to work with Tom DeLay, to work with Trent Lott, to work with Dick Armey and Newt Gingrich, a lot of names that people may kind of put their head back when you mention their names. But I didn't have the luxury to put my head back. I didn't have the luxury to say I'm not going to work with Republicans because I saw a community, I saw my community that was dying on the vine. When I grew up in the 1970s, we used to have a swimmobile that would come down my street, and the poor black kid, because we didn't have swimming pools, the federal government provided resources for that. When I grew up in 1970, I saw a community where marriage rates were really, really high. I saw a community in 1970 where most black men were working. So as we went through the 80s and the 90s, I'm not going to blame Carter or Bush or Clinton or Obama, but we've seen a system in this two-party approach to dealing with policy where, and I learned this from one of my pastors, Reverend Wendell Anthony, who's the president of the NAACP down in Detroit. when I started working for John Engler, the NAACP in Detroit, the Urban League in Detroit, and the Malik Shabazz, Betty Shabazz, the Black Nationalist group, a lot of these groups had come together and they were protesting John Engler, Governor John Engler at that time, his welfare reform efforts. Jesse Jackson was there, Al Sharpton was there, the entire cadre of leadership from our community was there. And there were maybe three Black people working for Governor John Engler. I was one of them. John Engler kept trying to call Reverend Anthony, and he kept trying to get Jesse Jackson and all these guys on the phone to try to have a negotiation. Well, they wouldn't return his call. And it was so amazing to me. I think I was 24 years old to see how political strategy and political power works at a high level. When John Engler found out that I was a member at Reverend Wendell Anthony's church, what was then told back to me was, hey, can you come up and visit with the governor? And I had never been in the Oval Office at this point because I was only working for the governor for maybe three years. So I'd never even been in the governor's office. Mm-hmm. I was somewhere in a junior staffer. But that moment in time, the folks from our community empowered me. They took my stock up in the governor's office, and they took my ability to help influence policy up to a higher level. And here's why. Because they did not take the governor's call until I called them. And it was when I called them, they got on the phone, and we had a different type of discussion with the governor's senior policy advisors. And it was really at that moment that I said, wow, if I wasn't here, or if somebody like me who was not here, how would this situation have turned out? Mm-hmm. We probably would still be protesting. Long and short, my community didn't get everything we wanted, but we were able to get a little more than had somebody like myself not been there.
Yeah.
So that's what it means when you ask me, Kim, what does it mean to be a Black Republican? It means I have a commitment. And it means that when I'm in the room, I've got to be thoughtful. I've got to pick my shots wisely. Now, I can't, you know, jump up and down on every issue because that's not smart or power politics. I've got to fight on issues that I can win on. Now, there are some issues that I'll die on the vine on as well.
There's a popular skit by comedians Michael Key and Jordan Peele. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a few years old that suggests Black Republicans are all the same, that Black Republicans are monolithic, that they only care about, let's say, money. Are Black Republicans monolithic?
Not at all. I mean, it would be like to say all black folks are Democrats. You know, we may all, the majority of us may vote Democrat, but if you get 10 of my folks, our folks in the room, and start asking them some basic issues, I think you would find a little bit of diversity inside our community. I think we're a very diverse mm-hmm. community. Both Black liberals, Black conservative, Black Republicans, Black Democrats. In particular, since you asked me, Kim, directly about Black Republicans, you have, if you look at Black Republicans like a Condoleezza Rice and a Colin Powell, they are supportive of affirmative action programs. If you look at a Black Republican like Ward Connerly, he's against affirmative action programs. Or Gary, if you look at more recently Congressman J.C. Watts and Gary Franks, when you had the two Black originals before this crew that's here now, Gary Franks was adamantly against affirmative action, and J.C. Watts worked adamantly to support affirmative action in the Congress back in the early 90s. So when you start looking at, you know, a cadre of issues, you find Black Republicans are pretty across the spectrum. I mean, Condoleezza Rice, again, I'm using some names that people would know.
Right.
She's pro-choice. You look at K. Cole James, who's now the first female African-American to be president of the Heritage Foundation, which is the largest conservative foundation in the country. She's pro-life. So there's a broad range, yes, of Black Republicans. I mean, you have out of the 17, 18 candidates that ran for office in the Republican primary, I think, you know, we worked very hard as a group of Black Republicans to say no matter who wins, we need to have a Black Republican involved at some level on this presidential campaign. And so we went through our cadre of the Black Republicans around the country that have been cultivated and that are in campaigns and in fundraisings. And we systematically said, okay, Elroy, I went and worked for Rand Paul. We said, okay, you know, John, you're going to go work for Senator Marco Rubio. We said, you know, Eugene, you're going to go work for Jeb Bush. So we systematically said, well, who profiles where with these candidates? Let's put our people there. So no matter who won the Republican primary, we would have some people inside the White House and in the administration that could be echo chamber for us.
Mm-hmm. I think you raise a good point about strategically placing people of color on various campaigns or within the administration to ensure that those communities are represented.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both political parties do that. But I think that there may be a misconception or feeling that Black folks within the Republican Party aren't able to be as effective. Yes or no?
We're not as effective as I think we could be. And neither, I don't think the Black Democrats are effective as I think they could be. Look, if I were king of the world, and if somebody said, Elroy, you could make all the decisions for one day, here's what I would do. And then I'll go back to your question. There's what, 36, let's say it's 36 million African Americans in the country. Let's say 42% of us vote. So that's 12 million African Americans that vote. And I don't have the exact number in front of me. Out of the 12 million African Americans that vote, I would say take 5 million and you guys get involved in the Democratic Party up and down. I would take another 5 million. No, I would take 4 million. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I would do 5 million, get involved with the Democratic Party. I would take 5 million Black folks, get involved with the Republican Party. I would keep 2 million out. Mm-hmm. That 2 million would be our swing vote in the Black community. The Black Democrat leadership, they would sit down with the Black Republican leadership, and they would come up with a new deal. They would come up with a Black deal. Mm. They would then, of course, make it relevant to some conservative issues and some relevant to some liberal issues, because you got to have power politics and be smart, Kim. But the principles and the foundation of the deal would be the same. It's like building a house. The foundation is the same, but you may build a ranch house or you may have a colonial house. You take that deal, let our leaders that have been involved in the party go to the Republican candidate and the Democratic candidate. Before the primaries even start, you go early on and you say, if you could agree to this 10-point plan, we're going to take this back to the 2 million, and we think we can flip them and swing them your way. Could you imagine, had we been able to go to Hillary Clinton and had we been able to go to the 16 Republican, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and the 16 Republican candidates, said, here's our Black community 10-point plan. There's 2 million Black folks that's waiting on us, the Urban League, the NAACP, Leadership Council on Civil Rights, all the Black pastors and Black business. There's 2 million Black folks that are waiting on us to give them a nod on which way to go. You're talking power politics at that point. At that point, you're having a different discussion with Hillary Clinton. At that point, Kim, you're having a different discussion with a Republican candidate, because you're saying, I'm a Democrat. I'm going to deliver my 5 million. Mm-hmm. We're going to turn out. And imagine if I could, as a Black Republican, say, I'm going to turn out 5 million Black folks. But if you want to win, there's 2 million Black folks out there. Now, give me the tools, give me the resources, and agree to these policies. Now, you come back to the Black community. I go sit down with Donna Brazile. I go sit down with Mark Morial. You get the J.C. Watts's, the K. Cole James, the Condoleezza Rice's. You get the Jesse Jacksons. You get the Harold Ford. You get the John Lewis's. Then we all sit down as a Black community and we say, hey, what deal did you cut? Mm-hmm. What deal did you cut? Whoever cuts the best deal. Now you go back to the 2 million and say, guys, our brothers in the Republican Party, they got a better deal. So that's where y'all going this year. Now, what you do is at the end of the 2-year election cycle, we're going into year 3. If you find on that 10-point checklist that the Republican Party has not met a majority of those checklists, then you go back to the Republican infrastructure and you say, you know what? I can't hold this 2 million. Mm-hmm. They're getting ready to bail. You guys got to do something if you want to keep them. That's power politics. Until we're able to have power politics, we're just playing a game. Mm-hmm. It's a difference between having a power game and just playing a game. Right now, we're playing a political game. Now, we're doing okay. We got civil rights, okay? We got housing rights, okay? We've got 40 plus 52 CBC members. We have 3 Black Republican members, so we're doing okay. But the type of background and experiences that I've had, and I've been stripped down to nothing, I was a number. I'm not comfortable just doing okay, because I've been nothing. And it's not a big difference between being nothing and being okay. You're either somebody or you're nobody. And that comes from American Gangster and our good friend Frank Lucas. You're somebody or nobody. And I think we really, as a community, we have a lot of somebodies, but we have way too many nobodies in our community. And I think all 30 plus million of us African Americans, we all need to stand as one and be a somebody, but we need to be strategic. And I think, again, if I were king of the world, that's what I would do, Kim.
So we would use our vote, we would leverage our vote, depending on the landscape, to ensure that we affect the change that we want. So we wouldn't necessarily be married to a particular...
Well, yes, the 5 million Democrats, they need to show some loyalty.
Okay.
They need to play the game. they need to do the fundraising and go to the networking receptions and be involved in the Democratic Party and do all the things that political people do. I'm not talking about my guys in the neighborhood. They're not involved in politics. But the folks out here in D.C., the folks who are engaged in politics, they need to play the game. And the black Republicans need to play the game.
But we also need to work together.
You need to start by working together. But then you keep 2 million out. You don't take 80% of your vote, in my opinion, and have a presumption that it's already going to go to the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. I think that's a bad model. I think you take 40% of your vote and let the Democrats think they got 40%. I think you take another 40% of your vote and let the Republicans believe and know that they have that 40%. I think you keep, that's 80% of the vote. Now I think you keep 20% out and say, if you want to win, let's now negotiate. Because right now, black Republicans, our biggest challenge is it's hard to negotiate. And I think black Democrats, the biggest challenge is it's hard to negotiate. And here's why for black Democrats. Because the Democratic establishment says, well, where are they going to go? They're not going to go vote Republican. And they're not going to stay home. Well, now we've gotten to the point where we will stay home. Mm-hmm. But even when but that should not be our leverage mechanism to say we're not going to vote. Because way too many people died for us to vote. So we've gone from marching across the Pettus Bridge to people getting beat and kicked in the throat and getting dogs and fire hoses to vote. Now our leverage is we're not going to vote. What kind of leverage is that? That's not politically smart, right? And that's not power politics, okay? Power politics, again, is the Democrats saying, I'm going to deliver 5 million votes, Democrats. The Republicans saying, I'm going to deliver my 5 million Republicans. But there's 2 million independents out there. If you want them, here's what you need to do. We are not in a position as black leadership in the Republican nor the Democrat. I can't do that as a black Republican. And not one black Democrat could do that either.
Speaking of strategy, what do you say to people that suggest being a Republican, being a black Republican, particularly in this administration, means that you're voting against and you're voting against African-American self-interest? Is there a moral dilemma for black Republicans?
Well, I think there's a moral dilemma for anybody who's a human being. We wake up every day and we were born into sin. And I'm not trying to not answer your question, but I'm based on my experiences. There's a moral dilemma when you just existing. There's a moral dilemma any place you work. There's a moral dilemma raising kids. There's a moral dilemma when you work at the Urban League. There's always a moral dilemma because nobody is perfect. But to answer your question directly, because I don't want any of our listeners to think I'm not answering the question, are there a lot of issues? Are there too many issues that my party promotes that I do not agree with? Yes. Are there a lot of issues and too many issues that the Democratic Party promotes that I talk to some of my guys and young ladies that I've known from a long time that they disagree with the Democratic Party? Yes. But think about this for a moment, Kim. Was there a moral dilemma when Jackie Robinson joined Major League Baseball? They didn't want him there. Imagine had he not joined. Was there a moral dilemma when the first black doctor went and got their PhD? The universities didn't even want us at their school. Was there a moral dilemma when the first black lawyer went and joined a law firm and passed the bar? Was there a moral dilemma there? They didn't want us there. So there are always moral dilemmas in terms of somebody not wanting you there or infrastructure or institution. Is there a moral dilemma in war? Was there a moral dilemma when the Buffalo soldiers said, you know what? Many of our people aren't even free, but we're going to go fight. Was there a moral dilemma during the civil rights era, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, when many black soldiers had zero to no rights at home, but they went and fought anyway? I don't see that as a moral dilemma. I see that as strength and courage to say, hey, this system doesn't work 100% for me. Maybe it's 10, maybe it's 20. Those are just separation of degrees. So someone could say, make the argument, well, the Democratic Party provides and promotes more opportunities for people of color. Maybe so, maybe not. Depends on where you sit. But for most African Americans, that's what we believe, okay? What about the 10 or 20% of the things that the Democratic Party does that we don't support? Now, flip the script. Maybe it's 60% of things that the Republican are 70 or 80. What's the difference between 40 or 50% when you're not playing power politics? You're still losing. That's just like saying, oh, I lost the game, but I lost by 2 points. Mm-hmm. Or I lost the game and you lost by 10 points. So my team is better than yours. Well, you still lost. So based on my experience of losing everything in my life, of being reduced to a number and living in a gated community in a cage, my bar is just set a little bit higher. And I think for many people, maybe because we don't know what it means to really have nothing, and it's real easy to say, oh, well, this party is better than that party. But for me, it's not easy for me to say that Democrats are better or Republicans are better. That's just not an argument I want to have. The discussion I want to have is I want to go talk to John Lewis. I want to go talk to Maxine Waters. I want to sit down, and I have great relationships with them, and Sanford Bishop. And I want to say, look, we're black folks in America, greatest country, in my opinion, on the face of the planet. My daughter is a student at West Point. She's going into the Army. She's going to fight to defend this country. Are there a lot of things that I think the country could do better? Yes. But I'm so grateful that my daughter decided to say, hey, as a black female, out of the 1,200 students, I'm going to be one of 20-something black females to go do something that black females, maybe there's some resistance, and just don't do. As a black Republican, I like to sit. I like when I have the opportunities to sit down with my black Democrats. Right now, Mark Morio and Don Cravens, Kim and you and the folks over at the Inside America, my foundation, we're doing something pretty special. We're bringing black conservatives and black liberals and our white, brown, red, and yellow brothers to the table who are Democrats and Republicans. And we're sitting down with the Speaker of the House. As you know, just 2 months ago, mm-hmm. we sat down with the Speaker of the House, and I thought we had a good discussion. We're sitting down with Ms. Pelosi. We're sitting down with Senate Majority Leader Paul Ryan. We're sitting down with the establishment in Washington, D.C., as a community and saying, well, hey, you got black Democrats in here, you got black Republicans in here. These are all issues that we care about. So it can be done. If we're doing it at a small scale, there is a start to that. So, yeah, that's my answer to your question. Is it challenging? Is it tough to be a black Republican? Yes. Is there a moral dilemma? In my opinion, I don't see a moral dilemma. I mean, because I have a moral dilemma as being a human being trying to survive in this world.
Generally speaking, do you think there's a big difference between black Republicans and black Democrats?
Oh, yeah, it's a huge difference. It's kind of like, you know, so you got your Jack and you got black folks who are part of the bourgeois black class and their kids go to Jack and Jill and been in private schools. All right. Then you got some brothers and sisters who kids, you know, are not Jack and Jill kids, you know. They are just at home trying to survive. It's a big difference, socioeconomic, political outlook on life. When it comes to the political structure, I would say the majority of black Republicans, or a little more than the majority, maybe 3/4 of black Republicans, I think too many of them are excited to be in the party. I think too many of them are more interested in saying I'm the only one or I'm the first one or, you know, those kind of things. I think too many of them are. Now, in the Democratic Party, because I'm engaged in both, I still see some of that, but I see less of it in the Democratic Party. Why do I think that is? Because I think more of your black Republicans, especially in 2018, I would say, come from majority universities. Not many black Republicans have gone to an HBCU. Mm-hmm. Not many black Republicans know a whole lot of people in their family that have been incarcerated or have fallen on hard times. I think you see probably more black Republicans who were more of that Jack and Jill crowd. And I think you have a lot of black Democrats who are of that Jack and Jill crowd, but you also have a lot of black Democrats who are not of that Jack and Jill crowd. So I think that becomes the socioeconomic split with black Republicans and black Democrats. I think there's a little bit of an imbalance there. But you also have to put that in perspective. If you take 1 million black folks, statistically, they say 80% of them are Democrats. So now you're talking about 800,000 people that are Democrats versus 200,000. So who are identified as Republican, 8 and 2, that's 1 million, 80-20. So you do have to put that in perspective when you're talking about raw numbers versus aggregate numbers. But, yeah, there's a difference in terms of, you know, So philosophically, and the way I think more Black Republicans grew up, maybe private school, majority universities, a lot of them didn't pledge. Like most of the brothers that I know, they pledged. Mm-hmm. Most of the sisters that I know in the Democrat Party, they pledged. Not that many Black Republicans pledge. They don't know what frat life is like. They don't know what HBCU is life is like. Most of them went to private schools. They didn't grow up in inner city Detroit. Maybe they grew up rural, or maybe they grew up suburban. So there are some different experiences when you start talking about it. Now, in terms of philosophical beliefs, yeah, there's a big difference there. Many Black Republicans are pro-life. They believe in the sanctity of life. Now, there's degrees, mm-hmm. but many Black Democrats, at least the establishment class, because when I go home to Detroit, my grandma, if somebody was getting if some young lady was trying to get an abortion, they said no. Now, clearly it's your choice, but that Saylor family said, you know what? We're going to be with you every day. You're going to stay at grandma's house. We're going to get you through this. And if Auntie Betty or Auntie Julie or Auntie Joy can't take care of you, that little kid is going to stay with Nancy and Viola Saylor. Mm-hmm. So there was a part in the Black community where we encouraged life. This whole new political spectrum, it's politics, but I think most Black people would tend to encourage life. I think now what we've gotten into because of politics is to a legalese discussion about it. It's always the woman's right to choose. That should be her choice. But the question is, as a Black Republican, I'm going to advocate that you promote life. And as a Black Democrat, it's kind of hard to advocate promoting life when you're promoting choice. Unless you're going to do both, but you really don't hear a lot of that. You hear the argument saying, what's a woman's right? Whereas if you talk to a Black Republican, you'll say, we want that child to live, and we need to do everything we can. Now, the problem is the Democratic Party, my Black Democrat brothers and sisters, will then look at more social issues, education, and they'll want to put more funding in the education. Looking at healthcare, what President Obama did with the Obamacare, they want to create more healthcare opportunities. And I'm just speaking in basic terms. Mm-hmm. Whereas Republicans, Black Republicans, want to create more of a free market system. That doesn't always work out best for Black folks because we don't control the market system. So whereas more Black Democrats tend to say, well, hey, we need to recognize the environment, affirmative action, voting rights, healthcare, housing, we need to really lean on the government to provide that safety net. Black Republicans say, well, everybody should be equal. Well, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstrap. Well, heck, if you don't have no bootstrap, if you don't have no boots, how you gonna pull yourself up by some bootstraps? And that's what my Republican brethren's white, Black, red, yellow, and brown don't understand. Because they see a handful of Black folks driving Mercedes, they see these athletes, they see these entertainers. Many of them haven't been in a gated community. Many of them haven't been at, you know, Auntie Gogo's house. Many of them haven't been at, you know, Uncle John's backyard fish fry. So they really don't have that perspective. They didn't pledge. They weren't on the line. They don't have that brotherhood, that sisterhood. They weren't in the neighborhood. They weren't running the streets. So they don't have that experience. And so when many Black Republicans and white Republicans start making those decisions, I don't think they're making them because they don't care. I think they're making them based off of what they experienced growing up. And so that's where some of the dilemma comes. So if you start talking about from a social issue on both sides of the aisle, and then when you move past a social issue to, okay, what is an economic educational issue, you start seeing some splits there. But in short, I think what you start seeing is the Republican Party being more free market enterprise in general. And I think you see less reliant on government. And I think on the Democratic side in general, you'll see a greater propensity to say, to be more pro-government assistance, support. I think it's got to be a balance of both. It's like when we talk about trading with other countries. Well, if you just have aid, that's never going to allow people to really flourish and be the best that they can be. If you only have trade, what about the people who need help? What about me when I was 21 years old and I got out of the gated community and I wanted to just end my life? I needed a little bit of help, okay? So there are... And I made a bad decision. we all make bad decisions. Whether you spent too much money, whether you didn't study hard enough, whether you were born into a bad decision, bad situation, we all need help. And so I think that's where you start having a little bit of the breakdown in terms of how do you best move the community forward. So again, as a Black Republican, based off of my experiences, I feel grateful and blessed that I can take my experiences and sit in the room, and out of 10 battles, if I win one, that's one we won.
There's been a lot of, seemingly a lot of public pressure being put on the Democratic Party to be more accountable to Black voters, to be more inclusive of Black voters, to run more Black candidates, and particularly more Black women candidates. Are those kinds of conversations also happening within the Republican Party that you know of? Is there an intentionality there to attract not only just more Black people, but people of color to the Republican Party? I mean, you mentioned a moment ago that you think that Republicans just operate based on their experience, that you don't think it's necessarily that they don't care. That's just not their worldview. Is there a recognition that they need to diversify their worldview, and is there an intentionality to do so?
So you asked me a question. It's a great question, Kim. Thank you for asking me. But you asked me a question earlier in terms of are Black Republicans monolithic? So there's a segment or a constituency in the Black Republican Party that says, well, race, they take Martin Luther King's speech and they interpret it differently. Mm-hmm. I'll just leave it at that. And they really say, well, race shouldn't matter and we should just all be Americans. And they really want to take the colorblind concept and they have a different view of it. So you have some Black Republicans will say, well, we don't really need a African-American outreach coordinator. Why can't we just have a coordinator? They'll say, well, we really don't need a African-American candidate program. Why can't we just have a candidate program? I understand the approach. I do. But I think there's some white space or a gap between the Black community that might need a little bit more resources to run as a Republican, education. I think there's a gap between the Black community, again, like on these policy issues. So some Black Republicans take that same mindset, the pull yourself up by your bootstrap mentality and this kind of universal mentality, and they take it into the political system. Some Black Republicans don't believe there should be a congressional Black caucus. They say, why can't everybody just be a congressperson? So they just don't understand that or appreciate that approach. So you have some Black Republicans that are not big fans of trying to specific. They are big fans of having more Black people in the party, mm-hmm. but they're not big fans of creating the infrastructure and putting the resources to specifically target that. And that's where you get the gap. Black Republicans are big fans of everybody owning a home. Black Republicans are big fans of everybody having a great education. But sometimes there are a gap. There is a gap between your well intentions and then your actions. And so you see that with some Black Republicans as it relates to politics. Now, there are more. That's very small. The majority of Black Republicans on this issue, though, however, are working very, very hard to recruit and attract more Black people, more people of color into the party. So that's a small amount. But, you know, I'm not one, and sometimes I get on my Democrat brothers because they try to protect and defend the party. I'm not here to defend or to protect the Republican Party. I'm in the Republican Party to defend and protect my community. Mm-hmm. It's a big difference. So that's why I feel liberated and like I have the freedom to say, well, you know what, Kim? Some Black Republicans think we should just be Americans. But there are a lot of Black Republicans that might not say that yeah. because, and I get it, they have different experiences than I do.
All right. You are known in the Beltway. You're a powerhouse Republican strategist. You've advised various members of Congress and across various administrations. What advice would you give to new Black voters considering affiliating with a political party? They're unsure. They don't know whether to go right, left. What advice would you give to them?
It's really simple. I would say get a friend. One of you guys decide to join the Democrat Party and one of you guys decide to join the Republican Party. Forget about what the parties stand for. you and your friend, you and your wife, you and your brother, you and your sister, you and your husband, you and your cousin, you and your line sister, you and your buddy from the hood, you two, because there's strength in numbers. God says where one or two or more of us together in prayer, he'll be there. Spirit will be there. So get somebody. And you say, look, I'm going to go join. If you're in Michigan, I'm going to go join the Michigan Democratic Party. If you're in Michigan, say, I'm going to go join the Michigan Republican Party. You guys meet. You draft up things that you want to focus on. You then look at the party platforms and you say, well, okay, on the Second Amendment right issue, that's a big issue that separates and splits the Democratic and the Republican Party. Look, I grew up in Detroit. Papa Sailor, we call him Big Daddy, my dad, he had a gun in every drawer. I mean, I was shooting a gun at 5 years old. You know why I was shooting a gun, though? I never went hunting. I was shooting a gun because my dad worked three shifts. I was shooting a gun because the crackheads were always breaking in our cars to steal the doggone powder out of the steering wheel to take a sniff and get high. My dad wanted me to be a strong black man to protect my mother, his wife, and my sister. So he taught me to shoot. There were no such things as no safety checks and 24-hour period. It was Big Daddy who said, boy, I'm going to show you how to shoot. Don't kill anybody. You shoot the wound. Then if they keep coming at you, then you got to put them down. That simple. The debate that we're having now, and let's take that debate back a little further, in the 1800s, it was illegal for a black man to pick up a gun, right? So I'm exercising my right to own a gun, because at a point, there was somebody in my generation that couldn't own a gun. And then two, I was raised to protect my family. I now live out in the rural country. I live in Haymarket, which is about 48 miles outside of D.C. It's pretty rural. My son knows how to shoot. I travel a lot, because if something ever happens out there, he's going to be able to protect my wife and his sister. Now, you take that debate there, and again, there's a lot of white space between how many black kids are dying unnecessarily, how many white kids are dying unnecessarily, and you got to have that debate. But when you start with the foundations, I think as a black Republican, I start from the position to say, you know what? I want to make sure that a black person in this community, we never go back to a scenario where we once were, where we couldn't own guns, one. Two, I want to make sure that the black man, and women, of course, but I think it's the responsibility of the man to defend the woman, that black man knows how to shoot, he's had practice, so that he can defend his family. All right? Now, three, now the question is, okay, how do we deal with the senseless murders? But I start with those two premises and make sure as I'm moving forward, having that discussion when I'm sitting down with Republicans, that they understand where I'm coming from on this. I want black people to have a gun and own a gun, and I want black men to be able to take care of their family. That's why I'm having this debate, and that's why I'm standing on this side with you. You may, as a white Republican or another type of black Republican, you may have some different arguments. But then again, you get to that center ground and say, well, the real issue outside of why I'm supporting gun rights is all the people that are dying unnecessarily. And that's a different discussion. So what I would tell these two black people, one that has decided to be a Democrat, one has decided to be a Republican, I think both the black Democrat and the black Republican should start with that foundation. The black Democrat should start with that as well. In the 1800s, black folks couldn't have guns. And black men need to be able to defend their wives and their children and their women, okay? Start there, then you move to how do you stop all the carnage and death and destruction in our community. Because if you start somewhere else, maybe I'm more realist. I have concerns about having my gun rights stripped away from me, because I know that less than 150 years ago, we didn't have those rights. I mean, voting rights. I mean, we have a government and we have a system that if you're not on watch and if you're not vigilant, and well-intended efforts could lead to unintended consequences. So am I concerned about the gun rights issue going too far and maybe it not having the best impact for black community? What happens when they start saying, you know, if you live in a certain area, you can't have a gun? Who's that going to infect? That's going to be black folks. Now we're like disarmed? Come on. As a way to stop crime, that's not the right way to do it. So again, I'm bouncing around a little bit because I'm on the issue. But what advice would I give? Two black people, you get together, you get some foundational arguments, you look at the party platforms, you align yourself a little bit with the parties, you lead with what's best for your community, you work together, you join the party, and you engage, and you fight for our issues when you get a seat at the table.
As you begin to wind down, how can people follow you on social media or learn more about you or your work? Sure. Where would they go to do that?
Sure. I'm actually still on the typewriter. No, I'm just
you have a fancy smartphone sitting right in front of you. Don't say that.
I do have a Twitter account, and I have Facebook, Elroy P. Saylor, and I guess my Twitter account is eSaylor at Twitter.
That sounds right.
Or Elroy at Twitter.
They can just Google you.
Yeah, just Google me. Yeah, just go on the Google thing. Now, I told my grandmother I'm going to Google her in 1970, she probably would have smacked the heck out of me. I'm all over social media. If you just Google stuff, you can check out my go to InsideAmericaForYou.com, the number 4. I do know that one. Mm-hmm. And you can see all the great things that Mark Morial, Don Cravens, Kim, Kara, the whole team's doing, and myself and our Black Republicans, we were working together, mm-hmm. and we're doing some great things for our community.
So we like to ask, as a final question, each episode, we like to ask our guests, what is their call to action for the movement? So what is your call to action for the movement?
40-40-20, baby. 40% of us need to go be Democrats. That other 40% of Black folks that are Democrat, get out of the party. Go on over to the Republican side of the aisle. Bite the bullet. Suck it up. We've been in tougher situations. Trust me. It ain't all that bad. The 20% that doesn't vote, sit to the side. Let the 40% of the Black Democrats, let the 40% of the Black Republicans. Y'all get together. Have a fish fry. Go to King's Dominion. Go to Martha's Vineyard. Whatever you do, get together. Draft up our plan for 2020. And go to Donald Trump in 2020. Go to Elizabeth Warren or Cory Booker or whoever's going to be the Democratic nominee. And you say, you know what? Here's our 40-40-20 plan. And whoever can give you the best deal, then y'all go back and tell the other 20% to go vote that way. And then in 2023, if it's Trump or if it's Elizabeth Warren or Oprah Winfrey or whoever's the Democrat nominee, if after year two, they haven't met, 50% of our specific goals, then that 20% don't vote for them. Power politics. 40-40-20.
Thank you, Elroy. Right. Each week, we recognize an affiliate helping to advance the movement. This week, we want to take a moment to remember an Urban League icon, John Wesley Mack. Mr. John Wesley Mack was a civil rights leader and longtime president of the Los Angeles Urban League. While at its helm, he grew the Los Angeles Urban League to become one of the most successful nonprofits in the country, where it served more than 100 individuals each year and operated a number of innovative, results-oriented job training, education, youth achievement, and business development programs. In Los Angeles, John Mack's name is synonymous with civil rights. Mr. Mack began his career in the 60s and continued to work to improve quality of life and economic opportunities for African Americans for more than 50 years. He was an advisor and friend to Martin Luther King Jr. and Whitney M. Young, and he counseled elected officials and police chiefs on reforms to criminal justice, affordable housing, community investment, and more. Mr. John Mack passed away on June 21st and was laid to rest last week on July 10th. He is survived by his children and grandchildren. The National Urban League honors his deep legacy and prays that he will rest in power. Well done, Mr. Mack. As always, you can follow us on all social media at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Play. Kudos to our communications and policy teams here at the Washington Bureau and our editing team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to the National Urban League's For the Movement.